Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and you're listening to the 10 Adventures podcast. We are more than just a travel company. We are a community of active explorers who have been inspired by the outdoors. Join me as I sit down with real people to talk about their most epic adventures on this incredible planet. Welcome back to the 10 Adventures podcast. This week, we're going to talk about the newest long-distance path in France, the Hexatrek. You may recall we had the founder of this trek, Thomas, on the podcast in 2022 to discuss what he was doing. And today, we have Claire McCall on the podcast. Claire recently published her book, Hiking the Hexa, and we're going to talk everything about what walking the Hexa was really like. And we're also going to talk about doing this type of trip as a regular person, not some idealized athlete that we see on the homepage of almost any outdoor gear supplier these days. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Richard. How are you going?
So I'm excited to, you know, listen in on what it was actually like to hike the Hexatrek. But for people that didn't listen to the episode, geez, almost 2 years ago, can you describe what it is?
Yes. Well, it's basically, they call it a through hike, and it's a 3,034 kilometer hike in entirety, which is split up into six stages. And it starts, you can go either way, southbound or northbound, but it starts in on the border of Germany in a place called Wissenburg, and it goes through the Vosges, the Alps, the Doubs, the Jura, Ecran, and across the Pyrenees to a little town on the coast of the Atlantic, Hyundai. Excuse my French accent, not. So yeah, it's a bit of a trail, and the trails were all already there. They are mainly linking GR trails, so there's about 47 GR trails that they've linked up through this app, and it goes through the most spectacular national parks, about 14 national parks. And most of it is mountains, which is a fact that sort of eluded me, I think.
And this is a brand new trail, and you were involved, I understand, a little bit in getting the trail off the ground, somehow, you know, supporting the creation of an app. Is that correct?
Yes. So what the founders did is they did a call out to support the creation of the app. And at that stage, we had just been in lockdown in New Zealand. So in New Zealand, we really got a lockdown. It was pretty serious. I think we were at home, not allowed to go anywhere for about 3 months. So obviously, I was searching online, looking at a beautiful walk, thinking, let me out of here. And I did think of doing the PCT. But I think then the ideas of bears came into the PCT, and I thought, bears, I'm not so sure I can deal with those. And possibly because I was looking at long distance walks, the Hexatrek popped up into my Instagram feed. And from that stage on, I was absolutely hooked. I'm actually studying French. So I thought, this is perfect. It's God sent to me. You know, I watched Go on a Long Walk. This is in France. And so, yeah, I signed up to support the app, you know, and for that, we got the app for free once it was developed and just started to plan.
And so, you know, my understanding, this was one of your, you know, you'd done some adventures, but this was the first real long, you know, through hike you'd done. Why pursue, you know, an arduous through hike instead of, you know, something more leisurely?
I think basically I was slightly naive. I do a lot of hiking with my friends, my girlfriends here in New Zealand. We've got a fantastic system of huts, the Department of Conservation huts, where you can hut hike. And we've got 10 great walks, which are world-renowned walks, where you can go on multi-day hikes and stay in huts. And in my mind, I love those so much that I thought, a long distance hike is just like three, you know, just adding those together, 3 or 4 days here plus another 3 or 4 days. That's how it will go. So really, it was quite a naive perspective. And when I told my partner, James, that I wanted to do the Hexatrek, he's far more savvy And he did try to point out to me that actually there were quite a few mountains involved. And when he said the word mountains, I feel like I heard the word valleys. And I just sort of imagined walking through these wild flower meadows, beautiful mountains on either side. I didn't for 1 minute think I had to actually walk over the top of them. I thought there was some way we could probably get round them. So anyway, I did want to do a challenge. It's not that I was totally naive. I knew it would be a challenge, but I just was not prepared for the type of challenge it really was.
And so maybe talk a little bit more about what that, you know, what that challenge was for you. You know, you're somebody who is outdoorsy, who's, you know, I think I read you've summited Kilimanjaro, you're hiking in New Zealand, which has some yep. pretty rough terrain. What was the challenge that made the Hexatrek different?
I mean, it seems silly to say, but it's the length. It's that every day. And I thought I'd love that. I mean, I think before I went on it, I thought, what a freedom that must be. How amazing to not have to think about anything else and just walk and walk and walk. And I literally thought that I would want to carry on. I thought, I want to never stop. I want to kind of, you know, get to the end. We could only do 4 stages of it because we have work commitments. So we rented out the house and we took off to France, but we knew we were never going to be able to finish the whole lot. But I thought, well, you know, if I'm really loving it, I might just say, you know, don't worry about the work. Let's just carry on and make that phone call and say, sorry, I'm not coming back for that big project. But once I got on the walk, I think the mental aspect of it was far more difficult than the physical aspect. Just to keep going and going and going. And I found myself loving parts of it, beautiful, gorgeous mountains. But then at about 2:30 every day, I'd come against a wall and go, are we actually there yet? Have we made it yet? When's the camp? And, you know. So, and I also discovered so many more fears than I ever thought I had. I mean, who just thought I would ever have been frightened of cows? Suddenly I developed this absolute fear of cows. And I think it's because I'd done too much research.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Fantastic. Because I felt like a total idiot walking up to cows and going, I can't walk through these cows. And Joseph said, well, you could go home or you can walk through the cows. I was like, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to walk through the cows.
It's surprising. Cows look so docile, but when you get a herd of them charging over to you, to like, I think they're just curious.
Yeah.
But they're big beasts. And in Europe, you're kind of always going through a cow field somewhere. And I always wonder, what the hell am I supposed to do here? And I always look around, where's a fence? What can I get around? And never had a bad experience, but They're frightening animals.
They are, and the certain groups in certain parts of the walk, there were actually signs up because what's happened is that the wolf, the European wolf, has naturally reintroduced itself to. We were actually in Switzerland at that stage because for one part the Hextrek goes through a little bit of Switzerland. And the wolf has reintroduced itself to this area, and the cows are spooked. And you can tell because they have a far more aggressive nature than normal dairy cows down the bottom. So it's amazing what sort of fears you do discover you have that you never thought.
So can you maybe describe what stages you did and the type of terrain you went through?
At first, we thought we were going to start. This is coming from the southern hemisphere. We thought, well, we'll start in the south because it'll be warmer there in May. We started in May, so we'll start with the Pyrenees. And we were planning that, and then we joined this Discord group, which is a really good group. If anyone's thinking of doing the Hexatrek, then definitely join up the Hexatrek group on Discord, and you've got all these people, including the founders of the Hexatrek, they're talking about different aspects. You can ask any question you like. And as soon as we put our plan on there, because we thought that there would be less snow because it was south and it was warmer, somebody went, you know that the Pyrenees are quite high. in comparison to the Vosges, which are in the north. So you're likely to come across a hell of a lot of snow in the beginning of May. So we swiftly changed our plan and started walking through the Vosges. And the Vosges is stage one, goes from Wissembourg all the way down to Lac Leman, which is Lake Geneva. And that's 670 kilometers. So that was our, we did that stage, and that stage was incredible. I mean, it was full of culture and history, lots of old castles and ruins and beautiful forest, just gorgeous, dappled light to walk through. Just loved it, absolutely loved it. And also you get a little bit of the German culture there. So I would come up to people and try and practice my French and try and talk French to them, like foresters, you know, having their lunch. You know, they have their lunch properly there, even if they're working in the forest. They set out a little table, put their little, you know, red and white checkered tablecloth on, have their bottle of beer, and they eat lunch properly. And I'd come up to these people in the forest and want to talk French, and they'd look at me blankly. They were actually talking Alsatian, which is a dialect of sort of Germany French. So so I just loved all of that history and the culture and the people and this, you know, old crumbling monuments. And so the Vosges were beautiful. And there are some very high parts of the Vosges as well, like the Ballon d'Alsace, etc. And also, what I loved about the Vosges is the refuges, which are most of the ones in the Vosges are unguarded, which means they're not serviced. So they are huts that Club Vosgian members donate for free. You can sleep there for free. And they range from something like that looks like a garden shed to these really beautiful stone buildings with hand-hewn tables to eat on. And most of the time we were there on our own. There was nobody else. We would come up to this gorgeous hut and we would go, right, surely there must be some hikers about to flood in here. And there was nothing. We were just on our own. You know, you'd make a fire. They leave a wood stock for you. I don't know how they do this all for free, but it's just an incredible system. So that part, so much to say about the Vosges. I think the Vosges doesn't get enough good publicity. The Alps steal it all.
that's so true.
Yeah. The Alps, it's always about the Alps. And they are stunning. I mean, we crossed Lake Leman and then we were into the Alps stage, which is the second stage that we did. And of course, it got a lot harder. I mean, the Alps are, as my partner James, who came on the walk, described it, they're like a series of waves and they just keep going. Just like that, up and down, up and down. And the thing is, we were walking, because we were walking sobo, we were walking up the more gentler side. But when you came to the down, it's kind of like a big drop off. So for me, the up was far easier than the down, in fact. And
oh, really?
I mean, my knees ended up looking like little watermelons. I thought they were getting nice and muscly, you know, like lovely muscles in them, but actually they were swollen like watermelons the whole trip. Anyway, so yeah, we did two stages and that was over 1,000 kilometers of the actual Hexa trek.
And was your route in the Alps, was that following the GR5?
Yes, it mainly follows the GR5. Yeah, absolutely. And we met, I mean, it was the pioneer year. And so we would say to people, yeah, we're hiking the Hex Trek. And they'd just look at us blankly. And they were mainly doing the GR5, the people that we met. There would be we had only, I think Thomas, who you've interviewed before, was in front of us. And that was incredible because he was, you know, discovering all the tricky bits and telling us, and we were like, oh, let's go this way instead. So yeah, it was a great adventure. Even though we only did two sections, it was 1,000 kilometers, and then we carried on with the GR5. We decided to change our route and we carried on the GL5, and I wanted a natural ending point for it. And we thought ending at the Mediterranean was a natural end to the route. So we went from Germany to the Mediterranean. And changing the route is really hard when you've got into that kind of a through hiker mentality. It makes you feel incredibly guilty. But I have to just keep telling myself we walked 1,300 kilometers.
Hey everyone, this is Richard, and I just want to take 30 seconds to let you know that if you are enjoying these stories and are interested in embarking on your own adventure, then head over to 10adventures.com. At 10 Adventures, our specialty is booking private and custom active holidays. Jump straight from dreaming to doing without any of the hassle of travel planning in between. Join thousands of other travelers who have already booked with 10 Adventures to destinations in over 85 countries and experience more of what our planet has to offer while making memories that'll last a lifetime. Now back to the podcast. Well, it's funny, there's always the discussion of people who are doing a through hike of, you know, do you do variants? Do you, you know, take a lift if it's into town or things like that? And what I've always felt is do whatever feels right for you. And sometimes there's a variant that's not the official path, but it's super spectacular. It makes sense to, you know, deviate for a day just to get a great, you know, a great experience. You know, there is no right way to do these things. It's, you know, the journey is more important than, you know, following every specific footstep.
Yeah, I think you never know what you're going to feel, especially if you haven't done a through hike before. Like, I hadn't done anything of this scale before. Like I say, the hardest thing I'd done before this was climbing Kilimanjaro, and that is hard, but in a so different way. So I don't think you ever can tell what you're going to be like on a trail. And what we never thought that. We thought we're not going to be purists, and if we want to catch a bus at certain stage, we will, and that'll be fine. But the instant we set foot on that trail, catching a bus or hiking or hitching, I mean, not hiking, hiking, hitching was just not on the agenda. And I never thought I'd feel like that. I felt that that was cheating, not changing the route, but what was cheating to me was to actually take public transport. So we walked every single step if it wasn't the steps we imagined we'd be walking.
And how long was your total journey over those, you know, 1,000 or 1,200 kilometers?
So, yeah, we did 1,340 kilometers, give or take, and we took 64 days. So we weren't running it, but we were enjoying it. And we met so many people, and I think when we met a couple of Swiss women, and they were of my age, and they were so much fun, and they had a really planned out agenda, whereas we were only looking 1 or 2 days in advance in our preparation for how long we were going to walk and where we were going to walk to. They had a, you know, through the Van Oise National Park, they had like a 15-day itinerary. And I just looked at it, and some days it was only 12 kilometers. And I thought, oh my goodness, that looks great. So we just adopted it, slowed our walk down quite a bit. And I had so much fun during those days. I mean, it was just, we had people, you know, other people to talk to. I ended up playing Scrabble in French with them. And they were just so much fun. It was definitely worth slowing it down. And we speeded it up after we left them. But yeah, these are the type of things you got to sort of take when you can, you know, you get that opportunity.
You know, I think that's one of the nicest parts of going on, you know, these types of trips, whether it's a bike trip or a walking trip, is you kind of find other people who are going about your pace, and for a day or a week, you end up just kind of getting to know them in a way that you never have these interactions, usually with people from different parts of the world. I always found staying in the mountain huts were also really good. You know, you're all packed in, exhausted from a day of hiking, and then you're eating, you know, you're eating on these long tables, sharing a meal, drinking some red wine. Did you stay at any of the huts as well, and were you able to find friendships there?
The huts, we definitely stayed in serviced huts, which here in New Zealand, that, you know, a hut is basically a bed and you definitely cook your own meal. So to find these serviced huts in France was incredible. I just can't believe they get all the ingredients up there. It's just unbelievable. Some of the remote places that you can actually stay and be in relative luxury. So I love the hut experience. And yeah, we did meet people at the huts, but the main people we met were the two Swiss women. I'm guessing because they were like midlife hikers like myself, we really gelled with them. There were some fantastic younger people doing the Hexa Trek in their 20s and 30s, and they were great, but they were just, you know, on a totally different sort of mission to us. They didn't care. Some of them were running through it. Some of them were like, you know, taking far longer time than we ever could or would. So when these two ladies came along, it was just fantastic. And we still keep in touch with them. In fact, we went back the year after to France because we fell in love with France. That's one of the things that happened was we just went. We had so many people on the trail that helped us. Locals, walkers, there was just unending kindness. It was unbelievable. And I'm not talking about trail angels because they don't really have trail angels there. These are just people in little villages or out walking the hills, give you this kern of advice or, you know, share. Once we ran out of food and grumpy restaurateur, well, he seemed really grumpy to me. He was very proper and I was like, can we pay you for a couple of bread rolls? And he was like, oh, off he took to the restaurant, came back with them, you know, and threw it some fruit. And he was just so kind, even though he was grumpy looking. So yeah, just meeting people in the huts was fantastic. And meeting people on the route was fantastic. And the huts are, I can't speak highly enough of them. But so, you know, inexpensive and it's very sad, though, that some of them are actually closing because the heat wave in France, which they've endured the past 3 years, as far as I know, because there's not enough snow in the winter, there's not enough water to keep them going through the summer. And they actually, some of them have to close, which is really, really sad. But the ones that are there and still operating, fantastic.
I hadn't heard that climate change was affecting huts in the Alps, but it's true. You know, the weather that's happening in the Alps, I know we spent some time in the Dolomites a few years ago and we'd rented a little villa and it was like 36 degrees and we called the owner and he said, it's never been this hot before. We've never, ever had a need for air conditioning until a couple of years ago. And yeah, it's, you know, we're seeing it right before our eyes. Like, these changes, huts that have been around for 100 years can't operate because of, you know, there's all of a sudden no more snow melt for water. It's sad because it is, you know, kind of the quintessential experience. You know, it's the little alpine villages and then it's these remote mountain huts where they make you a great French or Italian or Swiss or German or Austrian meal with wine or beer and all the other people that is just so wonderful. I'm interested, you talked a little bit about finding other people your own age. And you also talked about younger people. And one thing I always felt is there's like this idealized outdoor person. And if you look on ads or social media, it's people in their 20s who are incredibly fit.
Yep.
But actually, when I go out to the mountains, it's like here in Canada, it's the most diverse place in all of Canada. You have young and old, you know, people who have been, you know, generations in Canada, people who just moved to Canada the year before. And, but I don't think people maybe realize that. And what was it like for you, you know, your first big trip, were you, you know, kind of, worried about, hey, is this something that's appropriate for me and kind of, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you get to a certain age, you start, and when people in positions of authority start to look about 12 to you, I think you realize then that you've lived more than half your life. And you have to get going and do something. And so I'm very aware of it. And I, you know, when you things start to creak and groan, you think, "Quick, get out there into the mountains. If you want to do this now, do it." And I would encourage anyone, you know, to try it, because once you start, I only started hiking in my 40s. And I can remember that first hike. It was just a day hike, but it was up something called the Pinnacles. And I was like, part of the Pinnacles name did I not understand? And I kind of got to the end of it where it was going vertical with ladders into the rock. And I was so frightened, I actually didn't make it that time. I've since been back, and I've obviously got, you know, improved, which just goes to show you that, you know, you can start late, but you can still improve. And I've got to the top. So, walking in my 50s, like I say, I'm quite physically fit, but I never felt fit enough, especially for that long haul. I mean, there was always, every morning you'd get up and go, okay, which bit of me is niggling this morning, and will it walk itself out? And usually it did. And we were very lucky that we didn't have any blisters, no injuries. We did have COVID, which was a bit of a full stop on the walk for a bit. I think James got it first, and I was beating him up hills and all sorts, and I was thinking, this isn't right. And turned out he had COVID, so we had to stop for a bit. Only a couple of days though, you know, we were itching to get out of there. We wanted to get on. We had a schedule.
Oh, so I'm interested, you know, doing this type of trip with your partner, it's not often as adults we spend 64 days with one person, kind of 24/7. You know, what was the impact of spending that much time together?
It's funny, that's the question that so many people ask me, or ask me before we were going. We're like, how will you get on? So I had no worries at all with that. But I have to say, James is a bit of a saint. With my complaining, and I don't know why he hasn't, you know, he didn't poison my morning coffee or push me over the edge of a cliff sometimes, because I'd be going, "Are we there yet? Isn't that a shorter way?" That kind of thing. And he's just incredibly patient. And I feel like he slows himself down a little for me, but we actually do walk at the same pace. So that's one thing, because I know that if you've got totally different paces, it's never going to work. Walking, well, I think it just drew us closer together in the end, because we've got so many amazing stories from that walk. And, you know, you come back from a big, big adventure like that, and all you want to do is talk about it. And, you know, within about the first, your friends within about the first week, their eyes are starting to roll, they're falling into a stupor. But you've got someone you've done it with, you can go over and over and over those stories and relive them. And that's part of it. It's, you know, memories that we'll have forever.
Yeah, there's something special about shared experiences. You know, the good ones are great, but also the tough ones. And I have a story that's not suitable for the podcast about getting very ill with my girlfriend that is now my wife. And yeah, we still talk about it once or twice a year when we're out backpacking, because it's those hard things that you endure together that I think, you know, really it adds something to relationships.
Yes. I mean, you definitely have to have the right person, because I think somebody else might have just left me. I mean, there was one instance where James was saying, because he was the navigator, of course, I don't think we would have made it very far with me being the navigator. And I would always be asking, "Well, where is this next certain point?" Like, and he would say, "Just around the corner." And then one day I said, where is the lake? And he said, "It's just around the corner." And I said, "Which corner?" And because we kept going around these mountain bends, and I kept expecting it to appear, and it wasn't there. And he said, "That corner," and he stomped off. And I thought, right, I'll do it all by myself. But, you know, I came around the corner, and there he was waiting for me, and we finally found the lake, had our lunch together, and really it didn't last long. That was the only time we ever had a bit of a fallout.
You wrote a book after your trip, and I think that's really interesting. And I'm wondering, does writing a book change, you know, how you reflect back on your trip? Is it a different, do you feel like you have a different experience because you not only did it, but then you've spent months reflecting and reliving it while writing your book?
I think it's a fantastic thing to do, because even if it's not a book, if you write a journal after you've come back, because it's so easy to forget things, and especially when it's a 64-day process, and you know, most people spend about 4 or 5 months doing the whole hexatrek. It's just a great process just to go through your photos and write things and remember people's names and write things. Oh, remember that happened in that spot. Because otherwise it's very easy to forget it. But writing the book has been a challenge. Self-publishing the book, probably a bigger challenge. The writing wasn't so much, because I'm actually a journalist, so I'm used to writing stories about adventures and things like that. But I feel like having the book out there has changed my view of the... I've had some people say, but you didn't finish the hexatrek. How can you even write about it? And I found that very challenging to accept, because I feel like, you say, there's so many people out there of all ages and stages doing what to them is a huge challenge. And just because they changed halfway through, or they didn't actually walk every inch of a through hike, does that invalidate their experience? I feel like we are flooded with, like, hiking has almost become a competitive sport and a glamour sport at the same time. I mean, just the other day we walked up a fairly substantial 16-kilometer hill in Queenstown, which is in the South Island of New Zealand. And right at the top, there's just an incredible view. But there were all these people changing their shirts and putting on new tops and brushing their hair and waiting in a queue to go out to the end point to take the photo that made it look as if they were there looking glamorous and gorgeous on the end of this hill. And I just thought, what's happened to hiking? writing the book has made me explore a whole lot of stuff like that, and my thoughts about it. And I get it. I love it that there are young, beautiful influencers out there doing their thing. And it's better than sitting at home playing TV games or something like that, video games. But it does have the effect of sometimes making people who are maybe a bit older feeling slightly inadequate.
it is strange. I don't understand the... there's a famous lake here in the Canadian Rockies, and if you go up there in summer, you'll just see literally a line of people taking the exact same shot. It's always, you know, a young woman dressed up very glamorously with her arm hanging back and her partner's holding the hand, taking the photo. And you can see 50 people doing the exact same shot. If you just go on Instagram every day, there's 50 or 100, probably more than that, because it happens every 10 minutes. And it's interesting how people experience nature now, and they experience these things. And I'm not a social media guy, so it doesn't make sense to me. But as you said, if they're getting out into nature and they're getting all those benefits of, you know, just being outside, being, you know, exercising, if it means they have to take some photos like that, hey, I think that's great, because there's just so many benefits to these, you know, hikes, even day hikes.
I agree that there's worse things they could be doing, right?
Yes. Hey, Claire, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was great hearing your story about the hexatrek. If people want to find your book or want to find you, can you maybe share where you are online?
Yes. So the book is on Amazon, and it's called Hiking the Hexa, And my personal website is Claire McCall, which is my name, .net. So if you want to get in touch, ask a few questions, not too technical, I can definitely answer those.
Excellent. So I'll put those links in the show notes. And I urge you to check out Claire's website or the book to, you know, just get a really honest take on doing an incredible journey. And with that, thanks everybody for listening to this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. We'll be back next week to explore the world and hear about more epic adventures. Start planning your own adventure by visiting us at 10adventures.com and listen to other episodes of the 10 Adventures podcast on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your podcasts.